Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Advocacy Learning Center's quarterly keynote lecture. This is a webinar format that we are going to use today, and I'm Shamita Das Dasgupta from Manavi, and I work with Practice International on the ALC project. We are very happy to welcome classes B, C, D, and E to this webinar. And I'm happy to tell you that Class A has graduated already, and Class B is almost ready for its own graduation. Before I introduce you to our keynote speaker today, I want to tell you with a very heavy heart that one of the great leaders of our movement, Ellen Pence, has passed away on January 6th after a very brave struggle with breast cancer. I don't have to tell you about Ellen, her dedication to ending violence against women, and the work she has done in all our areas of understanding this work. I know all of us will continue to miss her and her brilliant guidance in our work. I believe we can best honor her memory by carrying on the work that she so loved in the best way that we can. I realize that it is not easy to go on today, but the subject that we are going to talk about was very close to Ellen's heart. So let me just recap to you, reiterate to you the intent of the keynote program. The keynote address, a keynote lecture, occupies a very important place in the curriculum of the Advocacy Learning Center. It is designed to inspire our thinking and provide us with information about social change work that is going on in other areas. It challenges us to stretch our imagination, exercise our analytical skills, and strengthen our advocacy. It's not just only to enlighten us with information, but challenge us to move our understanding beyond our areas of work, that is, in sexual assault and domestic violence organizing work. We have a great speaker today, and today's keynote address is titled Turning the Tide, Racial and Gender Justice. We are going to have this conversation led by Rinku Sen, a leader in the racial justice movement with extensive expertise in feminism, immigration, economic justice, and journalism. Rinku is the president and executive director of the Applied Research Center. So welcome, Rinku. As I said, that today's keynote is focused on racial and gender justice issues. Rinku Sen is going to guide us through a discussion on these topics and the issues that arise from there. There will be time for your questions, and there will be some interactive slides like what you have just gone through. And you can always, throughout the presentation, send your comments, thoughts, reactions through the chat function that Liz has just explained. Now, I've already said this, but let me just introduce Rinku a little bit more. Rinku is the president and executive director of Applied Research Center, a think tank that uses media, research, and activism to challenge racism and sexism and find solutions. She's an award-winning journalist, activist, and leader in the movements to eliminate racism from society. I am delighted to welcome Rinku to today's today's discussion. Thank you, Rinku.
Thank you, Shamita and Liz and Beth. I'm so excited to be with all of you today. I wanted to start out by just giving you all a little bit of background of my my political journey. I think that it helps ground the presentation, and it'll tell you quite a lot about me, I think, but also about, I think it may also reassure you that anyone, no matter where they come from and what kind of politics they have, they've started with, anyone can become a great advocate and organizer for gender and racial justice, because I did not definitely start out that way. I wasn't born with a deeply embedded political gene. I come from an immigrant family. I was born in India in the late 60s and immigrated to the States when I was 5 and a half in the early 70s. And while I was growing up in mostly in factory towns, working class suburbs in the northeast of the United States, I really spent most of my childhood trying to figure out how to be an American and to the extent possible, blinding myself to the racial and gendered and immigrant-related realities around me. I did my absolute best to fit in, and I thought fitting in meant watching hours and hours of television every day and eating hot dogs for dinner and speaking English without any kind of an accent. And those were the things I concentrated on and tried to do until I was about 17 and went to college, and was really fortunate at college to make a couple of very good friends who took me in hand during my second year. In my second year at school, I was in the middle of a campus where a number of really interesting political happenings were taking place, and one of them was the start of a very lively racial justice campaign, that had been sparked by the beating of a black freshman by two white football players on my campus. So that incident had sparked all these rallies and actions and meetings, and I was sitting all of it out because I understood myself as a quote-unquote purely American and thought that race had nothing to do with me. And one night I was hanging out with two of my friends, Yuko and Valerie, and there was a rally the next day that they wanted me to go to. And they said, Rinku, you should come. And I said, oh, I'm really not interested in that. That's not for me. And they gave me a talking to. They did an intervention. They said, listen, Rinku, you are not a girl anymore. You're a woman now. And you're not a minority. You're a person of color. And they basically told me it's time to grow up and get with the program and go to the rally. And when your friends talk to you like that, with that challenging kind of love, not the pandering love that lets you sit in a corner cowering and hiding from the things that you're afraid of, but a courageous love that challenges you to come out of the corner and makes you feel safe enough to do so, when your friends challenge you like that, you kind of have to go to the rally. So I did, and I had the most remarkable experience that I still can't really explain to this day, some 25 years later, in which for the first time since we had immigrated from India to the United States, I actually felt at home. It wasn't a very it wasn't the most effective rally I've ever been to in the course of my career. I will say that it was a little bit straggly. It was early in the campaign, and yet that was the moment where I understood that being an American was not about looking a particular way or what you ate. It was really about making a commitment and an investment in the place that you were in the community that you were in, and doing everything you could to make that community the most effective and inclusive and compassionate community possible. And I had the further experience after being involved in that early rally and getting involved in that campaign of actually winning things that we fought for. And that was what really turned me on to the process of community organizing and of direct action issue campaigns as a very effective tool for social change. So many of the things that I helped with my fellow students and sister students to win that year still exist on that campus today. For example, we won a new Third World Center, which was a home for the students of color on campus. That is still standing on campus. We won from the gender end as a measure to prevent sexual violence and keep women safe. We won a dusk to dawn escort service on campus. That escort service still exists today, many decades later. And so, or at least 2 decades later, almost 3 decades later. And so that was how I learned that there was a process by which people in a community could get together, analyze the problems that they were facing, understand where those problems lived in the institution that ran their lives, where those problems got solved or became made to be worse in the institution, and then challenge the institution with a new power base and actually won concrete things that would make a difference in the day-to-day lives that people led, and as well as a difference in the relations of power between the community and the institution. So that led me into community organizing as a career, and I spent about 14 years, the next 14 years, organizing people of color, often women, around poverty issues, education, housing, healthcare, kind of the full range of things that we know need taken care of. Toward the end of my time as an organizer, I began to think a lot about the media. I started to feel very proud of many of the local victories that we had won and that I had participated in and contributed to, but I also understood that local victories weren't enough, that you had to be able to fight the war of ideas, and that in order to fight the war of ideas, we had to have a better way to reach people with our ideas than to knock on the door of every person in the United States who might be open. So that made me get interested in the media, and I decided to go to journalism school when I was in my mid-30s so that I could learn how the mainstream media teaches, how it trains journalists and editors, what it thinks is a good story, and how it measures its success in the world. So I went to journalism school, and then I took over the Applied Research Center. And what we do at the Applied Research Center is have a mission of popularizing racial justice ideas and preparing people to fight for them and to implement them. In order to do that, in order to do that popularization as well as the teaching of the implementation skills, we work through 3 programs. They are our journalism program, which is mostly consists of colorlines.com. I'd urge all of you to check that out. It is where we cover the nation's race news every day with a strong emphasis on the intersection of race and class and gender. Our second program is research, and our final program is something we call the Leadership Action Network, which is comprised of individuals and groups across the country who are implementing racial justice ideas. So, let's go to the slide now. I'm moving them myself, and you can all follow them. I wanted to just provide a definition of racial and gender justice so that we would have our eyes on a prize. And I'm just going to give you 2 seconds to read that definition. And I want to note that some of the key words in this definition are proactive, policies and practices, and then toward the end, power, access, opportunities, treatment, and impact. So we are very clear that winning justice has to be a proactive process. We can't just be reacting to things that other people are doing to us. We have to be actually putting out fairly ambitious ideas about the way society could run, the way things could be arranged so that we can produce equitable power and access for all. I'm going to go to the next slide. We have found it useful in our work to draw some distinctions between equity or justice, which we use interchangeably, and some other very commonly held ideas. So the first distinction is between equity and diversity. So we like to talk about the ways in which diversity is an important first start, but it is not the same thing as equity. I like to use the analogy of a party. If you are invited to a party and you like the person who invited you pretty well, you respect them, you might go to the party. But if you arrive at the party and the music doesn't suit you, let's say it makes your head pound or it's not very danceable or you just don't like it and you don't have any ability to change the music, then you're not going to stay at the party very long. So diversity is about the invitation to the party. It's about getting the bodies into the room. But it doesn't necessarily speak to what people are able to do once they are in the room and whether they're able to actually influence the agenda, that is, change the music. The second distinction we like to draw is between equity and equality. Equality tends to mean the same. Everybody gets the same amount of something, or everybody gets something that looks the same. And we have a lot of that in U.S. society and to some degree globally now, where we get these race and gender neutral looking policies that don't seem to be targeting any particular group, seem to be fairly universal, and yet they end up having a disproportionate impact on, a negative impact on one group or another. So a good example of this is that in the United States, on paper at least, it would appear that every public school gets the same amount of money based on headcount, the number of students that they have. And that is true for federal funding. And yet, if you go into a suburban school in the United States and you go into an inner city school, it becomes very, very obvious that these two schools are not working with the same amount of resources. And that's often because private systems feed money into suburban schools, or our system of having property taxes fund schools also creates this link between housing value and taxes and the amount that goes to schools. And so if we talk about equality in public school funding, it does not actually get every public school student what they need in order to have a really good education in this country, in spite of nominal equality in the funding. So finally, we like to talk about equity or justice, and what that means to us is that everybody gets what they need to live a dignified and constructive and communal life, a life in which they are safe and have the basic necessities of life, but a life also in which they are able to contribute to their community. So those are some differences and some of the reasons why we really insist on equity and justice language rather than diversity and equality language. On the next slide, we will look at how racism and sexism operate on four different levels. And this is your slide that shows you the four levels altogether, and then I'm going to go through each level on its own. So the first level is the most individualized level, and this is what we call the internalized level. And every single person on the earth has internalized biases, things that they believe in their own minds about themselves and about about other people. These can be notions of superiority or inferiority, but the human brain is designed to discriminate, and so all of us have these ideas about ourselves and others. When they're just operating in our own brains, they don't really matter. They don't have so much of an effect on other people, and they are there nevertheless, and they're highly individualized. The next level is the interpersonal level, and this is when we begin to interact with other people, and this is the place where power comes into the equation. So if Beth and I or Liz and I are out in the world and we have notions about each other, then we might treat each other badly and that might hurt. That might not be such a great thing. But if one of us has power over the other, then it's a really different situation. So if one of us is a teacher and in charge of grading the other, or if one of us is a landlord and in charge of deciding whether or not the other can get housing, or one of us is an employer. When power comes into the equation, these interactions between people that express their biases have a much greater effect, certainly a greater effect than when they're just in our own minds and not having an external expression, but an even greater effect when one of us is actually carrying out actions in a position of power. Two more slides, and then we'll take a break to just see if there are any questions, or three more slides, actually. The next level, then, is the institutional level, and this is about entities in a society. This starts to get into the ways in which we are organized as a society, any society. And institutions can be anything from a family to a public school to your local health department to your federal government or national government. And when we're talking at the institutional level, we're usually talking about a single issue area. So it might be an individual school, or it might be your Department of Education, an individual hospital, or your public health department. And this is the level at which we begin to get into the rules, the policies and practices that shape our lives and that govern our behavior. So when the rules are written down, we call them policies and laws and regulations. But when the rules are not written down, we call them practices. And practices can be just as dangerous as a written policy. So, for example, there is no written policy in medical schools that says that, you know, we are to train doctors so that they understand when they have a black patient who exhibits signs of heart disease, they are not to offer that black patient the most aggressive and most modern treatment options. The doctor is meant to send black patients to the, you know, mediocre treatment options. There's nothing written down in medical schools that says that should happen, or in hospital protocols. And yet we know from study after study about the experiences of African American people in hospitals in the United States that again and again they are routinely offered the less good treatments for heart disease. Another example from the world of sexual assault, there may not be a written policy in a police department, for example, that says, you know, when you come across a domestic disturbance, I'm using that euphemism deliberately, when you come across a domestic call and there's a man and a woman, and the woman says, you know, he hit me, and the man says, she hit me first, there may not actually be a written policy that says both the man and the woman have to be arrested, even if it's very obvious that the woman is in much, much worse shape than the man is. And yet, again and again, we know police departments will arrest both a man and a woman in a situation where there is a dual accusation of violence. So institutional racism and sexism is about where the rules begin to be set up in the entities that shape our lives. And then finally, we're going to go to the structural level. And this is the most comprehensive and the most challenging in many ways way to look at racism and sexism. And the structural level refers to the ways in which institutions interact with each other. So this is, you're automatically into working across issues when you're dealing structurally, and you are automatically looking at history and culture as well as the rules of the moment and what they are pushing forward. So, for example, there's a phrase known as the school-to-prison pipeline, and that is a very pithy way of doing a structural analysis of the relationship between public schools and the public education system and the criminal justice system. It's an analysis that essentially says that if you have public schools shaped in a particular way, providing a particular set of services or not providing them to their students, then those students are going to have a set of interactions with the criminal justice system that are highly predictable. And we know that this is a structural analysis that works because the private prison industry, excuse me, it's extremely dry in my office, so my throat is drying up. We know that the public private prison industry actually does its productivity projections based on third grade reading scores. So they will look at the third grade reading scores of a particular community, and they will say, based on what these reading scores are like, we know that this community is going to be ripe for a private prison to be built 20 years from now. So that is, that school-to-prison pipeline is a structural analysis that shows multiple institutions interacting with each other. They can interact in a way that either compounds the harm of racism or sexism, or they can interact in a way that closes those gaps and that gets rid of that harm. I'm actually going to skip over the next slide. Yes, well, first I'm going to put up this feedback slide, and we'll just leave that up for a second, and then I'll go to the next slide. So I'm assuming that people are giving us feedback on this question.
Hello, Rinku?
Yes,
hi.
Shamita.
Can you hear me?
Hi.
Hi.
Yes.
And maybe we should just take a small, little bit of break to ask questions and see what is going on. You're presenting some really challenging questions, and we it'll be good to invite the audience to comment or ask questions at this point.
Yeah, I actually just want to do one more slide, and then I was going to take a break to do
okay.
those questions. So I'm going to go past the feedback slide and go to this last one, and we'll wrap up this part of the presentation and then carry on. So the main thing that we try to do is even though there are these four levels on which racism and sexism work, the internalized, interpersonal, institutional, and structural, and we need to be we will need to have strategies that address all the levels at different points. In general, our obsession in the world, and certainly in the United States, is to focus on personal prejudice, is to focus on the individual. We have many, many messages that say nothing can change until the individual changes. And in fact, that's not entirely true. Lots of other, you know, laws can change, and then individuals can change following the laws. It's not always that an individual changes or a group of individuals change and then they change the policy. Sometimes you need the policy to actually force some change at the internalized and interpersonal levels. And even though the individual levels are really critical, most racism and sexism at that level is unconscious. People don't know that they are acting on these biased ideas. So if something is unconscious, getting people to focus in on it and change themselves can be very, very challenging. And the idea that this is a chronology, those four levels, you start at the individual and then you work your way towards structural change, I have quite rarely seen that work well. What we know, as I think you all know from your own life experience, is that individual change is a lifelong process. We don't ever finish getting rid of all of our biases. And so if you have the notion that first I'm going to work on my own brain and I'm going to get rid of all my biases and then I'm going to be ready to have some interpersonal interactions and make some friends, and then once I have those together, then I can make some institutional change. By that timeline and order, we would never make any political change. We'd never make any change in the rules because you'd never really have enough people having gone through enough individual change to build a consensus around the change in the rules. So we have worked very hard to change the focus from being purely about the individual, purely about personal prejudice and personal behavior, to being about institutional and structural inequity. And we're asking not the question of who's a racist and who's a sexist. Our goal is not to root out the racist and the sexist, but our goal is to figure out what are the rules and arrangements that are causing inequities and what can we do about those. All right, so I'm going to pause at that point and check into the chat. And Shamita and Liz are going to begin sending questions my way.
Okay. So I think this is a good time to stop for a second and invite all the audience members to comment or ask questions through the chat line. And this is the question that was put in. What you've been talking, Rinku, is extremely important, and one of the ideas that we have been promoting and focusing on in our Advocacy Learning Center. That is, rather than individual work, which is of course something that we have to do, in terms to alleviate individual problems of violence. But the whole idea that violence against women is not just individualized, or it's not just the quirks of a few bad men, that there is a structural and institutional component to this. So therefore, collective work and collective efforts are essential. I think this, what you've been talking about in terms of race and racism and sexism and challenging those issues, is similar and, in fact, the same. Moving from individual or addressing it from the individual point of view to a collective action. So let me ask the participants at this point to look at the slide that is on and respond to it as best as you can. That is, the collective effort on women's groups would include one of these. Choose any one you want, or choose all of them if you want. And you will see the pie chart changing in different ways. But at the same time, let me ask, while we wait for some questions to come in, let me just ask, go back to one of the issues that you brought in, Rinku, the difference between equity and equality. And I was thinking that the way you define equality is giving everybody the same. Is you know, obviously problematic because historically, when groups or certain groups are left behind and you suddenly start with equality and not equity, then those groups are already left behind, right? Some groups that are already ahead are going to get the same as the ones that are left behind, so the groups that are left behind have no opportunity to catch up in that instance.
Right. Well, there are, I think that what you're talking about, Shamita, is the notion that that a rising tide lifts all boats. It's a notion of universality. You will often hear President Obama, for example, talk about that. So when people ask the president, as they did when the mortgage crisis first broke out in the United States, when people asked him, well, you know, what do you propose to do for black homeowners who have lost their houses in this mortgage crisis? He said, well, we're making a number of changes that will help black homeowners. They're disproportionately affected by the mortgage crisis, and so they'll disproportionately benefit from the changes that we're making. But the problem is that even though they would benefit from the changes we're making, the gap between black homeowners and white homeowners would not get closed that way. So, Shamita, I think that's what you're referring to, and that is definitely true. But there's a deeper problem with equality, and I think I might be, in this response, I might be answering for Jenny's question. So, Jenny asks this question, are there not instances where we do want equality, i.e. equal rights for all, like women versus men or LGBT people versus straight, etc.? And Jenny, yes, there are times that we want equal rights in some way, but I would have us really question the word equality as the correct word. I think there are many ways in which equity helps with that. And here's the problem with equality, one problem, and a problem I didn't mention earlier, which is that sometimes the people we're holding up as the standard for equality aren't getting a great shake themselves. So, do we want women to be equal to men in a world that has creates a mythology around the value of certain forms of leadership, male forms of leadership, male violence? Do we want women to have equal right to violence that men have, or do we want to rethink the way human beings deal with each other and deal with each other's bodies? For example, right now in when there's enormous unemployment all over the world, many people are saying right now when there's huge unemployment in all communities, for us to talk about bringing the employment levels of people of color, for example, to the same level, to an equal level as the employment of white men. In fact, it doesn't do us much good unless the white men that you're dealing with are super wealthy white men, because other white men are heavily unemployed and suffering a lot in terms of their employment. So the problem with equality, from a more philosophical point of view, is that it doesn't help us redefine some of the practices that we have that we want to be more critical of that are societally accepted. And I think you can get similar benefits by using equity. So, for example, if you wanted to have gay marriage be legal so that gay couples and lesbian couples were able to have a dignified and constructive and compassionate life as straight couples are, equity gets you there and also gives you a chance to think about the quality of straight relationships and what we might want to do to make those more enriching as well.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Are there any other questions that are coming in? Please feel free to put that in. And I do have another question for you, Rinku.
Okay.
You said something that was really interesting to me. You said human brains are wired to discriminate. Which is, that's something that is a very, very important issue to bring up at this point. If we are wired to discriminate, and our brains are wired to discriminate, how could we think about eliminating discrimination, prejudices, any of that? Because that's part of the organizing principles,
mm-hmm.
either class or race or gender or, you know, short, tall, you know, whatever that might be. And
yeah, that is a wonderful question, and it actually leads me directly to my next slide. So is it okay to go to that?
Yeah, let's do that. Is there any other question? Let me just ask one more time. Mm-hmm. Please feel free throughout this conversation to send in your questions or comments through the chat room. If there are none at this point, we'll move on and go into Rinku's presentation. Mm-hmm. And but you know, anyway, feel free to send your questions in, and at the next break, we will bring it in.
Thank you. Here we go to the next slide. I want to spend a little bit of time right now talking about framing, the concept of framing and the process of framing. Framing is an absolutely key skill for advocates to have, because they are the notion of framing is going to be key to understand if you want to persuade people to support your new policy ideas or your new practice ideas, or even to think about something you're pointing out as a problem as really a problem. So just to start with some definitions, frames are dominant systems of thinking. They're basically world views, or you could think of them as a lens through which we see everything around us. So they're dominant systems of thinking that evoke the morals, standards, and aspirations of a society. Now, so, for example, if I say to this group or almost any group, if I say the Good Samaritan, many people, even if they are not Christians, which I am not, I was not raised Christian, and yet I totally know what the Good Samaritan is. It's the story from the Bible of Jesus, you know, during a time of great suffering, coming upon a person, a Good Samaritan who took care of him. And I know the Good Samaritan story, and so does just about anybody I ever say those three words to. And if I also say to you, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, you would know what I meant, that was a notion of self-reliance and individuality and independence and not relying on anyone else. And so I can say those three or four words, and people will know what they mean because they evoke a frame. Those frames have been hardwired into our brains through thousands of years of repetition. People recognize the Good Samaritan because not just you have heard that story a million times, but so did your parents, your grandparents, their grandparents, going back, you know, really to the time that human beings developed language. So repetition hardwires these frames into our brains. And the frames are triggered by communications devices, by images, symbols, metaphors, and stories that connect to our deepest beliefs. And you will notice that in those communications devices, none of those devices are data. Frames are not triggered by data. They are there. They operate in the, I believe it's the right brain, if I have the brain sides correctly. They operate in the right brain, and the human brain then uses these frames to do all that discrimination. It has to figure out, you know, is this an enemy or a friend? Is this person a source of food or someone who's going to take my food? Is this a situation that includes danger that I should run from? Or is it a situation that will provide comfort and that I should stay with? So the human brain develops these ideas, these dominant systems of thinking through the repetition of images, symbols, and so on. And when the brain sees a person who is not like the person who owns that brain, it puts that image into a category of good and in my circle, like me, or a category of bad and not in my circle and not like me. And part of our job as advocates who are advancing a racial and a gender frame is to, one, try not to trigger the discrimination frame that is going to work against you, but to trigger the frame, either the collective good frame or common good frame or human rights frame or human dignity frame that is going to work for you. Let me just stop there and see how we're doing on questions, because I know that is a lot. I'm not seeing any in the chat, but let me just see if Shamita or Liz want me to do anything with that.
Yes, I do. I do want to go. The framing is a very complex idea because although, you know, we know that we can frame any issue in different ways, right? And different ways. But what you're talking about is the framing that has gone on for historically.
Yeah.
And has really gone into we have internalized it.
Yeah.
The question that comes in is, and we're talking about, you know, what you're saying is images and symbols and metaphors and stories. These are the pieces that have really gone in. For example, we have these images of heroes, and most of the time when we say the word hero, we think of a man rescuing somebody.
That's right.
So, you know, here we have those images. The point is, how do we get out of it? Or is that just a futile struggle on our part?
No, it's not futile at all. Here's the thing to remember. People have competing frames in the same brain. So I can have the Good Samaritan frame in my brain, and I can also have a bootstrap frame in my brain. They both are there. It's just in some people, one might be more dominant than the other, and it all has to do with what you get primed for, what you get rewarded for, what you hear the most in the course of your actual life, not just in the course of, you know, your family's life for many centuries prior. So let's just take a little example. Let's consider the notion that most people in their deepest, the most hidden parts of their brain think, they believe that women belong to men. Women are on the earth to serve men, reproduce for men, provide for men, comfort men, bring men wealth. You know, we are here to be about men. So that's a frame. That's there. We've got lots and lots of messages and images reinforcing that frame. And then let's say we have another frame that we want to move, which is every human being is her own human being, belongs to nobody, belongs to herself, you know, has self-determination. No one should be able to, no human being is a slave. You know, you could be enslaved, but no one is created a slave. So those are two competing frames about the role of women in relation to men, about the position of women in relation to men. And when you are, so if I'm an advocate and I want to generate public policy that enables women's independence rather than their subservience to men, I have to tell stories that are about independent women. I have to tell stories about independent women. I have to dig deep. We do have like mythological histories that are about the heroine and about the very strong woman, about the goddess. I have to dig deep into those. And this is not to say that I need to be talking about the goddess to a reporter when I'm giving an interview about domestic violence or sexual assault, but it is to say that when I'm crafting a framing and communication strategy to push forward the piece of policy I want to push forward that will enable independence among women, it means I have to have that goddess somewhere in my head. I have to be thinking about how to express the goddess in modern terms, contemporary terms that fit with the context, the geography, the institution, the age, the constituency that I'm working with right now. Does that make sense, Shamita?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay, yes, great. No problem.
Yeah, please go ahead. And I do ask the participants again to send in your questions. And Rinku, I apologize. I'm when I put myself on mute or unmuted, it just beeps, and I'm probably interrupting you.
I'm not hearing anything, so it works fine for me. All right, I'm going to go fairly quickly through the next bits because I want to make sure that there's a chance for just open-ended questions. So as I mentioned earlier, data is not one of the things that triggers frames. In fact, when someone hears a piece of data that contradicts this dominant frame that they already have, they throw away the data. They don't throw away the frame. And that's because data isn't those things that trigger frames. And we can kind of understand it if the human brain changed itself based on people giving it new data all the time, it would never know who it was because people lie to you and try to take advantage of you and so on. So the brain tries to protect itself by dismissing data. And so that means, it doesn't mean that you cannot use data, but it means that you must use data to serve the story that you're trying to tell. And the main framing function is to create a narrative around this problem that you're trying to solve. And a narrative always has these four elements. It always has character, a character or multiple characters. It always has a setting or a context. It always has a plot. Things happen in a narrative. They don't stand still. And it always has a key idea. So, okay, we have another feedback question, but I'm actually going to go past it and go to a couple of stories, and we can go, if you want to put the feedback question back up, Liz, while I'm doing stories, you should feel free. I'm just going to tell two quick stories that bring all these elements together. So the first one is about the Idaho Community Action Network. This is a statewide policy change organization in the state of Idaho. It's a very white state in the country with a long history, although many contemporary changes, but a long history of radical white supremacist politics. So compounds of white supremacists learning how to blow things up and things like that. So in Idaho, the Community Action Network is a statewide group that represents white members, American Indian members, and Latino members, and has families, low-income and working families, from all of those three groups. And one of the things that they wanted to do in Idaho was expand the state children's health insurance program. That's a federal program that provides insurance, health insurance and health services for kids who qualify up to a certain income level. And the network found that when their members would go to apply for this program, that they would regularly be turned down, even though it was very clear that they were eligible. And so they decided to do a testing project. This is a research process where you go in, you send people with similar characteristics to apply for a job or apply for an apartment or buy a car or something, and you just track what happens to them. And in this case, they decided they wanted to do a testing project, and they decided to test by race, that they would send in matched trios, one white mother, one American Indian mother, and one Latino mother to apply, who are similarly matched in terms of their qualifications to apply for state children's health insurance. And when they did that, they discovered that they sent in 27 people, and 26 of them were denied. 27 eligible families, 26 denied. And they found that everybody had problems with the form. The form was too long, people would make mistakes, and it was hard to, and then they'd get rejected and never really know why. They found that everybody had problems with the hours that the state children's health insurance office was open. You know, working hours, that was when people themselves had to be at work, so they couldn't be at the office, the state office, applying for and dealing with the problems with their children's health insurance. But But in addition to those problems that affected everybody, they also found that the Latinas, when they went in, would be asked all these intrusive questions about immigration status. How did you cross the border? How many kids in your family are illegal? And I use that word illegal in quotes. Who's the father of these kids? You know, all these questions that you just, the federal government had said, you're not supposed to ask these questions. There are no children without immigration documents are not eligible for state children's health insurance. And so, but it doesn't matter if they live in the same family as a child who is eligible. The child who is eligible is supposed to get the insurance. So if the organization had not done an explicit racial analysis of this problem that everybody was having, which is obviously a problem really affecting mothers and families, then they would have solved two-thirds of the problem and solved it for two-thirds of their people, but they would not have solved the problem for everybody. And just at the same time that they were running that campaign, Congress was debating expanding this program, the State Children's Health Insurance Program. And I'm just showing you a slide now of the way in which Republicans in Congress framed the program in order to prevent its expansion. So they framed it as socialized, Clinton-style Hillary care for illegals and their parents. Now, there's not one accurate word in that whole acronym. It's not socialized. It's not particularly Clinton-esque. Hillary didn't come up with it, and it isn't for illegals or the parents of anybody. No parents are ever eligible for SCHIP. And yet, those are the words that Stephen King used. Steve King used in order to trigger a notion of families who use SCHIP as freeloaders, in order to trigger a racialized and gendered notion of the freeloader. So that's example number one. The next example I want to talk about is of the National Domestic Workers Alliance in the United States working with domestic workers organizations in other parts of the world to get the International Labor Organization to pass a convention on the rights of domestic workers. It's the first such convention ever adopted by an international body, certainly the first adopted by labor. And it establishes a baseline of rights for domestic workers, again, doing a racialized and gendered analysis of what those workers need. I'm going to go back one slide and just, I'm not going to tell this story, but I'm going to show you this graphic because I think it's a useful graphic. So when you are organizing or building a collective, an advocating collective, and let's just say that you've got the center of power, maybe that's your police department because you're trying to reform the police department, or in this example, it's the owners of the restaurant industry. So you've got the center of power, and I think of each body of people who relate to that center of power as a concentric circle. So the people who have more access to that center of power will be in the concentric circles closer in, and the people who have less access will be out at the margins. When you're developing an advocacy strategy or an organizing strategy, and you start with the people who are easiest to advocate for or the easiest to organize because they're a little bit closer to the center of power, then you're gonna, the imperative is to keep going toward the center. It's not to go out toward the margins. So if you do that, then you will make some change for the people who are closer to the center of power, but you will probably continue to marginalize the people who are already at the margins. If you split that and you go out to the margins first, you start with in sexual assault, for example, maybe you start with undocumented immigrants who are the most afraid of police and public institutions in general, hospitals, police departments, schools, counselors, etc. If you start with undocumented women who are out as, you know, on the outer margins, and then you work your way in, then you're going to pull along other women who have a little bit more access to that center of power. But again, if you start closer to the center, you're not likely to go out. So as an organizing and constituency building strategy, you really want to do this analysis of where people are in relation to the center of power so you can figure out where you need to start your organizing. All right, I'm going to just introduce you to one last tool, and then I'll wrap up the presentation part of this. This is a tool that is on our website. I will put the URL up on the chat in just a second. So the tool is a racial equity impact assessment, and it could also be easily adapted to do gender equity impact assessment. The idea of it is basically like an environmental impact read. You know, when a new building is getting put up somewhere, the powers that be, the government, makes the developers of that building fill out a form that says how the building is going to affect the environment around it. Is it going to create toxic leaks into the groundwater? Is it going to cause the need for more parking? Is it going to generate more traffic, auto traffic in that area? And so a racial equity impact assessment is a similar idea. It says that when you have a piece of policy, before you can agree to keep that piece of policy or add that piece of policy or change that piece of policy, you must analyze its effect on communities of color and on racial equity as a principle that that we are wanting to advance. So there are a set of questions, and I've just given you three of the questions here so that you can get a sense of them. But that's a tool that you can use to help build your agenda and to help build the case for the kinds of changes you want to advocate for. I am seeing questions in the chat. I'm going to do one last slide, and then we'll start addressing those questions and any others that come up. So finally, just to wrap up, these are three elements of a strategic framework that we use for moving racial and gender justice. So the first is to focus on structures and institutions in addition to personal prejudice. So we're not at all saying that personal prejudice and personal bias doesn't need to be addressed, but it probably needs to be addressed along with the rules and the structural arrangements of society. The second thing is to focus on impact rather than intention. When we begin to accuse someone of racist or sexist intention, which we do a great deal when politicians say bad things, for example, and so on, we begin to get caught up in a he said, she said, and we have to kind of prove that the intention we're accusing someone of having is really their intention. And frankly, you just can't ever do it. You know, as soon as I say something like Newt Gingrich hates black people because of what he said about, you know, food stamps and, you know, getting black people off the food stamps and onto paychecks, as soon as I start talking about Newt Gingrich and his bad racial intentions, he's going to pull out, you know, the one person of color who sits on his leadership advisory committee, or, you know, if he's Mitt Romney, he's going to pull out his Mexican cousins, or if it's, again, Newt Gingrich, he's going to pull out a position that he took with the NAACP some time ago, saying that, you know, all the money we're pouring into prisons should really be redirected to education instead. It's going to be very, very difficult for me to prove that Newt Gingrich is intentionally racist. But it doesn't matter, because the policies that he embraces produce terrible racial outcomes, terrible outcomes for communities of color. And that's what I can focus on to make my point and to garner support. And then finally, we have to be willing to talk about race and gender explicitly if we're going to make this work. But it doesn't have to be to the exclusion of other dynamics that are also key dynamics. Certainly, poverty and class and economics, key dynamics. Sexuality is a key dynamic in the world and in sexual assault, certainly, but in many other arenas as well, housing, employment, police violence, and so on. So if we do these three things, we focus on institutions and structures, we focus on impacts rather than intentions, and we are willing to be explicit without being exclusive about our racial and gender interests, then we can make enormous progress in changing the rules that we need to change so that people can live a life of dignity and compassion and constructiveness. So I'm going to just take a breath here, and I'm going to deal with some of the easy questions that are on the chat first, just to get them out of the way, and then we'll move to some of the more challenging ones. The Restaurant Opportunities Center is an organization that organizes restaurant workers across the United States and is increasingly working with restaurant workers globally to build a global movement of food service workers. The restaurant industry is highly stratified in the U.S. and I think in many other, certainly in Europe and in other countries as well. It's highly stratified by race and gender. The best jobs in the industry, and there are many, tend to be reserved for white men in the United States, and the most dangerous and poorly paying jobs reserved for immigrants and people of color. And women are generally shut out of the industry altogether. So I'm putting up on the chat the website for the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United, the national organization, and I'm also putting up the title of the book I wrote about them, which describes their strategy. So there's that. How do we use outcomes without relying on data points? That is an excellent question, Liz. And so the way you do that is that you look for the stories that that give you a clear sense of the outcomes. So, for example, if folks took a look at a report that we just put out called Shattered Families, Shattered Families is a report about how immigrants lose their children permanently to the foster care system and to adoption if the kids are in child welfare and the parent is either detained or deported in the immigration process. And we were the first people to collect national data that shows the scope of this problem. And so we had a great news hook, which was a number. We estimate that there are 5,000 kids in the country right now that are in danger of never seeing their parents again, because not because their parents abuse them, but because their parents have been deported, essentially. And but when we do all of our work on that problem, that 5,000 person figure is, it'll be about the third thing we say. So first we'll tell a story, then we'll talk about why the problem is a problem. We'll ground both the story and the description of the problem in the value that we place on family. No child should be ripped away from a loving family without reason. That was the value that we were advancing. Women are particularly affected by this problem when they're in a domestic violence situation. You know, freedom from domestic violence, another value. So our communication about this problem and about the impact that we want to show of our immigration policy and of our child welfare policy is story is like value, story, value, piece of data, story. Another value, story, value, piece of data. So you're just not leading with the data. You can use it, but what you're doing is illustrating the data through the stories that you have, and you're contextualizing the data by referring to the values that you want to get people focused on. All right, there's an email question. This is from Beth. This is Beth reflecting an email question. What strategy do you suggest to be effective and be able to change the focus and move to examine inequities? I would say that first, if you're in a group and you want to change the focus, first you have to spend some time learning, I think. I'm making a lot of assumptions about where this question is coming from, and if the person wants to send clarification, that would be great. But if I'm in a group and there's a lot of emphasis on the individual, you know, we have to get individual men to change their behavior and the way they think about women, and we have to get individual women to, make different decisions, and you want to shift from that to add an ability to look at the rules and arrangements, then I think the way I would do that is I would get my group of leaders together and people, stakeholders together, and say, listen, I don't think it's quite enough. It's going to take us a very long time to go man by man and woman by woman and cop by cop and change all these individual behaviors. And in the meantime, there are some institutional rules that generate certain kinds of behavior, and that we could get to generate some other kinds. You would have to have a couple of examples like that ready at the point that you even open the conversation. And I think then you'd want to get your body of stakeholders to agree to dig in on its own into a learning and research process. And you would then use that research process to examine what dimensions of the problem was your individualized strategy addressing, and what dimensions of the problem need something different, need a piece of policy or need to transform a practice that you know is common practice. I think you'd want to build some consensus and some leadership and some practice, some ability to do an institutional and structural analysis before you then, you know, generated a whole big, huge work plan that would require people to actually do a lot of things differently. So in any institution, you've got to build some consensus and some you've got to build a body of people who are willing to go to that next level. Okay, here's another question. If we want to change internal frames, sounds like you're saying the best way is to have the people most impacted by the biased thinking present their own experiences. So what's the best way to use the media to accomplish that? So this is a two-part question. So part one, the best way is to have the people most impacted by the biased thinking present their own experiences. So I am a person who believes that when you're trying to solve a problem, the people who are most impacted by that problem have to be at the forefront of solving that problem, of describing it, understanding it, analyzing it, coming up with solutions for it, implementing those solutions. Now, I don't think, though, that it has to be only the people most affected in those positions. So I do think that there's a role here both for someone who's been impacted directly by the problem, but also for someone who has a different kind of interest in solving the problem. So there are roles for everybody. So if we were dealing with race on this or with gender violence, you know, we need people of color and white people to be able to speak to the impact of bad racial policies, just as we need both women and men to speak to bad gendered policies. So part two of the question, what's the best way to use the media to accomplish this? So best way number one is to generate your own media. There are enormous technological advances that allow us to do things that we could not have dreamed of 10 years ago. We can make a commercial for our own policy, you know, we could make our own political ad, for example, focused on a policy that we want, and we can easily share it and get many, many, many eyeballs on it simply by putting it up on YouTube and then doing a really good job of distributing it. So strategy number one in terms of media is to create your own, and to do that in a way that is both manageable for your group and that is able to reach an audience beyond your group. The second way to do this is to develop relationships with other media outlets, and by generally pitching them, and by pitching, I mean calling up those outlets and saying, I've got a great story for you. Now, I don't know so well the kinds of groups that your folks who are on this call are representing, but for example, those of you who are from service organizations, it would be, I think, one of the things I've seen service groups do that has great potential is that they keep track of, you know, who's coming to them for what kinds of needs over the course of the year. And once a year, instead of just keeping those data internal and using them internally, they make an external report using the data. So, for example, I worked with the Workplace Project on Long Island, which helps undocumented immigrant workers deal with their labor issues. And every year they do a little report for the press that says, this year we got a great rise in workers reporting unpaid wages violations, or we got a big rise in day laborers encountering violence when in the course of their work day. And, you know, once a year they do something got a little distracted by the request for various resources, which I'm looking for. So once a year, they take their data, which they have to collect anyway, and they use it to generate some press about what their community is facing. And again, they don't do it just by using the numbers. They tell stories, and so that's also a really good way. And I think there are many, many good trainings and things like trainings and tools that that are about how to generate press for yourselves, and it's something that deserves its own lecture, probably in your keynote lecture series. So I can try to send some of those off, but those are a couple of ideas that might help on that front. And I am about to send to all of you by chat the racial equity impact tool. Okay. Maybe if there's a next question, someone could say it out loud.
Rinku, this, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. Thank you. I didn't know if I was muted still.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say that many of us, particularly smaller organizations that work in the area of violence against women,
mm-hmm.
we are actually charged with or given the responsibility of working in smaller communities of color, immigrant communities particularly. And what we end up doing is working at the margins. And the best that we can do, also because of the way our funders regulate our lives in some ways, we are pushed to change the people at the margins, right? The communities of color, women.
Mm-hmm.
For example, immigrant women are afraid of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's change their attitude about law enforcement.
Right.
However, the fact remains that the law enforcement is not necessarily very friendly toward communities or immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, somehow because of various things, maybe because of funding, because of who we are or what kind of impact we can have on the systems, our assessment leads us to, our situation leads us to work with changing people at the outside who are already
mm-hmm.
on the outside rather than moving towards the center, although that work is going on somewhat, but much, much more work is going on at changing the people outside.
Mm-hmm.
And that, from your presentation, that seems to be problematic by itself.
Mm-hmm. It is problematic. Mm-hmm. It assumes that the communities you're working with have a deficit that needs to be filled and that the problem lies with them rather than with the larger institutions of society. And I think this is a long and tricky question because I understand that much of the funding that you all are dealing with and that, people in my world deal with also tends to be service-oriented, they want to see results that are that are very easy to measure. You know, we got 20 women to leave their abusive husbands this year, or we got, X number of rape survivors to follow through on the reporting process in terms of the criminal justice process or something like that. So I think what you have to do if you're in that situation and you want to start moving differently, there are several things. So one thing is you have to generate some funding that allows you to shift the focus, that gets you, enables you to look at advocacy. And I realize these are hard choices to make. You know, the problems that we deal with, there are people every day suffering hard from those problems, and it's very difficult to make the choice to, not provide a service so that you can generate enough resources to advocate on a piece of police department's practice instead or something like that. But you have to do it. It's also a hard choice to watch, I think, one after another woman come in with the same problem year after year after year, for 30, 40, 50 years and never be able to change the piece of the structural arrangement that keeps generating that that keeps putting women in that position and keeping them in that position. So you have to generate some new funding, and you have to reframe where the problem is. So as you talk to your funders, you kind of have to, I would go through a sort of framing, strategizing process in my own mind. I would start to think about, you know, success stories I could show them from other parts of the country or the world, or even other issues that I might be able to draw, analogize to my issue. So you have to reframe where the problem is for your funders, for your supporters, and for the press. And if you do those two things, you might be able to create enough space to pursue some key advocacy goals. Starting small, of course, and that's fine to do. It's fine to start with the smallest thing that you think you can change.
Thanks a lot.
In a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I think we're coming to almost the end of the hour, and I wanted to summarize this and thank Rinku for just a very, very stimulating and challenging conversation today. And it's just your conversation and your presentation today, Rinku, really has, emphasizes again to us how difficult it is to work to eliminate racism and gender discrimination from our work. And all of us who work with immigrant communities, communities of color, recognize these difficulties as we move through institutions and institutions that are framed to think differently, not in the way of inclusion of differences and different types of communities. So thank you again for reminding us and giving us strategies and tools to work with that. And I was wondering if, Liz, you might have some announcements at this point? Thank you so much, Rinku, and thank you all.
Thank you for including me. And you can do it. It is hard, but it can be done, and the rewards are tremendous. So good luck to all of you.
Absolutely. We take heart from your words. Thank you. And your work. Thank you, everyone. Goodbye.
Thanks.